Hi, we're glad you could be here. It's a joy to be here tonight, and I would like to say a few words about the Institute and the program and the context in which Howard's kindly offered to write for us and to be here to speak. But I do want to thank Pat and the good people at the Cambridge Forum and the Harvard Bookstore, not just for being a gracious host, but for the lively and important work you've done for so long in stimulating authentic public conversation. So let me just take a few minutes. Pat said a few things about the Institute. Probably many of you have never heard of the Fetzer Institute. It's out in Michigan, and it's a private operating foundation that does support research, education, and service that explore the integral relationships of mind, body, spirit. It was inspired by John Fetzer, who was a bit of an iconoclast and visionary and kind of Edison-type inventor. And our main work is to support folks in awakening into and serving spirit for the transformation of self and society. And when we talk about spirit, we're not talking about any denomination, but really talking about the universal ground of being that one could say is at the center of all spiritual paths. The Institute, which is nonpartisan and non-denominational, believes that the critical issues in the world can best be served by integrating or attempting to integrate the inner life of mind and spirit with the outer life of action and service in the world. We view this as the common work that Fetzer shares with really an emerging global culture. And with this in mind, the focus of our mission is to foster awareness of the power of love and forgiveness in the emerging global community. So it's important to say right off that we are not exporting any agenda around love and forgiveness, but rather, because of our belief in the power of people coming together, we're committed to holding the space for true engagement around the spiritual qualities that live beneath all names. So in this context, let me say a few words about the Deepening the American Dream series. This project started in 1999 and was created by Rob Lehman, who is our chair of our board. He was then president of the Institute. And it was begun as a way to sow the seeds of a national conversation about the inner life of democracy, about the nature of our society in relationship with the rest of the world. To date, we've published 12 original essays and have given away close to 60,000 copies to a wide range of leaders and citizens all around the country, including members of Congress, therapists, spiritual healers, and interfaith communities in America and around the world. Our very first essay was authored by the philosopher Jacob Needleman. And in his work, Jerry profoundly put the question, quote, more than deepening the American dream, how do we deepen the American? Well, we're still learning how. To enliven these ideas, Fetzer has been sponsoring a number of public forums around the country, much like this, at the Library of Congress in San Francisco. Also at different colleges, we've hosted community conversations around these issues, and teachers have begun to use these essays as catalysts for a different kind of conversation about what America is and what America means. Last fall, Josie Bass published the first anthology, which is here tonight, called Deepening the American Dream, Reflections on the Inner Life and Spirit of Democracy. In an effort to surface the psychological and spiritual roots at the heart of the issues that face the world today, we're also starting a sister series called Exploring a Global Dream, in which we're inviting authors outside of America to speak about, as well, the world we live in. Through these essays, we've been learning a great deal about the intrinsic nature of who we are as a people. And these are the concerns and questions behind our want to gather. I recently learned that when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on that terrible day in 1968. Robert Kennedy was gathering with African American leaders in Indianapolis. And he was pulled aside by a Secret Service agent and told what happened. As fate would have it, he was the one who had to share that sad news. Stunned himself, he broke all normal speech and told everyone what had happened. And through his own sadness and disbelief, he asked to himself and to no one, "What kind of country do we want to be?" Today, on the spot where he spoke to the black leaders of Indiana, there's actually a statue of the two slain visionaries, forged back to back like Siamese twins of freedom, each opening their arms to the world. And we're still here to ask that question: what kind of country do we want to be? We're still waiting for that image of freedom to come to life. Our speaker tonight helps us live into that question. As many of you know, he's a remarkable elder who speaks from a deep sense of listening in the context of history. And he's kindly allowed us to publish a compelling dialogue that he and I had last year entitled "The Common Cradle of Concern." And as Pat said, if you haven't picked one up, they're free. If there are any left, you can take more than one and give it away to somebody else. We'd like you to have them. So now to Howard. And as many of you know, Howard Zinn is a rare historian. He has repeatedly pulled open events, past and present, with such honesty and integrity that we've been forced to reassess who we are and where we've come from, all in the service of where we're going. To do this, he has stretched the boundaries of traditional research and reporting. His now classic, A People's History of the United States, changed how we understand ourselves as a nation. It has challenged America to acknowledge its self-centeredness. It's called the question, how many sides must we seek and listen to in order to approximate the truth? Howard's empathy for the people he writes about never clouds his clarity, but only expands our understanding of the complex net of relationships that make up history. He is the author of over 20 books and is still an actively engaged citizen of the world. And his newest book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress, will be appearing in December by City Lights Books. It's a major new collection of essays on American history, class, immigration, justice, and ordinary citizens who make a difference. Jonathan Kozol describes the book as, quote, very important and timely, and he describes Howard, quote, as a modern-day Thoreau without the crankiness, but with all the elegance and wit of the original. Howard continues to be penetrating in the questions he asks of us. And this commitment to unearthing and describing the truth of our society and democracy over the course of 50 years has made his voice one of the steadfast ones by which we know where the winds are coming from and what they've done. He has stood tall in the midst of storms of all sizes, like some pennant strapped to the top of a mast. Is it any wonder that his writings are bare and essential then? As I said, in the winter of 2004, Howard was kind enough to explore some questions that I had sent along to him, and I was grateful that he even responded. And we spoke for several hours on a couple of occasions, and we then transcribed that and edited it together into the essay that you have. I'm deeply grateful to Howard for his openness to explore this conversation and for his goodwill in letting us share all of this more widely. Reading anything by Howard Zinn, as many of you know, feels cleansing in its truth-telling and is an affirmation from a voice that lives deep within us all. Please join me in welcoming Howard Zinn.
Thank you, Mark. I can't live up to that. Don't expect much from me, really. But I'm glad he feels that way. As Mark said, I only got to know him a couple of years ago, and suddenly he emerged into my life, and then I looked up his poetry. And I don't like all poetry, but a certain kind of poetry that I love, and it's a poetry that's understandable, that's clear, that's passionate, that speaks to us as human beings, that doesn't try to impress the academic world of academic poems. And so I was terrifically impressed with his poems, and I guess I told him so. Why not? And then we started this conversation, I found him a very astute questioner. In fact, I wasn't accustomed to a questioner like him, because he was drawing me into a part of consciousness that I had probably ignored too much, because here I was dealing with history and dealing with politics and dealing with political issues and so on, and he was going beyond that, not forgetting that, not ignoring that, but going beyond that, and talking about the deepest needs of human beings, talking about it in a way that didn't translate into, we must do this tomorrow, we must do this next week, but that was translatable into an approach to life, to society, which was very, very helpful to me in broadening my outlook and making me realize that it isn't enough to address the hard, logical arguments of politics and history. It's a good thing to do, and I like to do it. But it wasn't enough to do that, because most people in this country and elsewhere are not necessarily people who will respond to these hard political arguments, but they will respond to human feelings. They will respond to something existential and something profound that touches all human beings, and which then connects with the things that are going on today. So I've been very grateful to him for his poetry, and when he asked me to carry on this conversation with him, of course, I couldn't say no. And so I want to thank him for that. I want to thank the Cambridge Forum and Pat for... I listened to Pat before talking to a reporter for the Howard Crimson, explaining what this is all about, and wow, she was so good. I don't know what I would have said. The Cambridge Forum has done good work for years here and in other places. And I want to thank the Harvard Bookstore, because the Harvard Bookstore is, one of those bookstores. Well, let's put it this way. It's one of those bookstores that will carry my books. How can I resist praising the Harvard Bookstore? Carry other books, too, I must say, and wonderful books. All you have to do is walk into the Harvard Bookstore and look around, and it's hard to get out of there. It's a feast of ideas and literature. So need to thank the bookstore, thank the Cambridge Forum, and certainly thank Mark Nepo and the Fetzer Institute, which I had never heard of until Mark introduced me to it. And whoever knew that there was this institute in Kalamazoo, Michigan? You're not supposed to have an institute in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're supposed to have it in Cambridge or New York or someplace like that. But Kalamazoo, Michigan, I thought that took courage to set up an institute in Kalamazoo, Michigan. What am I going to say to you tonight? Probably not too much that you don't already know, but I'll say it anyway, because that's what teachers do. they very often tell people things they already know, but insist they remember it and repeat it until it becomes a force, a force strong enough to turn people's attention away from the books and away from the speeches toward life itself, so that people will then play a part in what is going on in the world today, because that's what we desperately need, for people to play a part. Because if people don't get involved, then we leave it to those, you know who I mean. We leave it to people who cannot be trusted. Because after all, although we are talking about the common cradle of concern, and there is a common cradle of concern among most people in the world, it's what gives me hope, the fact that most people in the world have the same needs and the same desires, the desire for peace and a desire to treat everybody equally, a desire not to see anybody homeless and not to see anybody without meaningful work. And by the way, the polls that are taken, and here I'm getting social scientific a little, but the polls that are taken in this country from year to year show there's a great disconnect between the beliefs of people when they ask these questions and the beliefs of people in Washington, whether they're in Congress or the White House. The very year that Reagan was elected, I remember do you remember him? Yeah. The very year that he was elected, I remember there was a headline in the New York Times, sweep for Reagan and his ideas. And then there was a story buried on page 23. It's always page 23, you say. A story in which they did a public opinion poll on where people stood on the various issues. And where people stood on the various issues was directly contrary to where Reagan stood on the issues. But here's a problem we face, that we don't really have a democratic structure in this country where there's a connection between what people feel and what people want and the policies that come out of Washington. Now, we like to think of ourselves as a democracy, and sure, we are more democratic than a lot of places in the world, but we are a long way from a real democracy. Because in a real democracy, the president would not be able to send the young people into war and to bombard the public with false information in order to get them to support it. In a real democracy, there would be honest information given to the public, which would enable them to judge whether a policy is right and wrong. In a real democracy, people would learn history. And if people learn history, then they react to the people in power with great skepticism. The people in power depend on our historical amnesia. They depend on the fact that we don't have the kind of history that will check up on what they say. But we desperately need that. If you don't have that history, and if you don't have the information, if your information is limited to the New York Times and the Washington Post and NBC and CBS and Fox News, if your information is limited to that, then we don't have an informed public. And then we have a public which is ready to accept whatever the government says, however foolish and immoral it is. So there's a disconnect between those people who are in power and most of the people in the United States. And when I think of a common cradle of concern, I think of the fact that I believe most Americans want the same things. They really don't want to go to war. They can be pushed into it. They can be propagandized into it. The young people can be cajoled and seduced into it. But basically, people do not want war. And basically, people are fair. When Americans see somebody in desperate circumstances, when they see pictures of people, the victims of Katrina or the victims of earthquakes in Asia, people respond. I believe if people are basically decent and basically have common sense, that decency and that common sense can be distorted, can be deflected by a very powerful establishment which dominates the media, and by a media which is cowardly enough to be dominated, and by a political system where an opposition party is not really in opposition. So we have, in order to create democracy in this country, and democracy is not there, it has to be created. And it's created by people who find that there's something they have in common. And then they act on that common cradle of concern. Because I believe, and I'm taking this from what Marx said about what kind of country do we want to live in. I believe most people do not want to live in a country that prides itself on its military power and uses that military power to browbeat countries and peoples all over the world. I don't think people want to be in that kind of a country. I don't think American people want to live in a country that countenances torture. Not at all. I think there's something that, yes, we have in common. 90 to 95% of the American people have something in common, and they really want a decent society. And our problem is then, because that common feeling exists, our problem is to connect with these other people who feel the same way. Mark Nepo reminded me of something I had written. I love to be reminded of something I have written, you see. Because it always sounds better when it comes from somebody else, you see. But he reminded me that I, at some point, I wrote about the Paris Commune of 1871, which was a remarkable moment in history where the people of Paris created a real democracy for just 3 months. But for 3 months, it was real democracy in Paris, of people making decisions all over the city, gathering day and night, making the theater free to everybody, giving education to women, which they hadn't had up to that point. And they realized, the people in Paris, the people in the Paris Commune realized that here they were, they had this remarkable situation in Paris, but they were all, most of the people in France were peasants. Most of them were living out in the country. They wanted to make connections with them. And so they took advantage of what was at that time the latest scientific achievement, the balloon. And they sent a balloon over the countryside, dropping leaflets which said simply, our interests are the same. And when we, all of us, recognize that, we will act on it. And it will not only help in changing bad policies in the country, it will help in changing our relations to other human beings and our feeling about ourselves. It will make life worth living. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Now we'd like to just kind of, it's going to be rings of conversation here. Well, one of the things that, you know, your new book is called A Power That Governments Cannot Suppress. Could you speak about the nature of that power and where you see that it resides in ordinary people?
Yeah, it's, I guess I chose that title. Well, maybe my publisher chose that title. Publishers are very arbitrary, tyrannical. They choose titles for their writers, and it's very hard to fight them. But this is a good publisher, City Lights in San Francisco, with a long tradition of the Beat Poets and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and all of those. And they are publishing this book. And so the title is A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. And what? And I guess it refers to something that that's a recurrent theme in my writing. And that is one of the reasons that terrible things happen in the world, that terrible policies are pursued, that wars go on, that people go hungry, that people go without medical care. One of the reasons for this is that people have no sense of their own power. They feel helpless. They feel, those are the people in the government, they have the power. The corporations, they have the money, they have the power. And who are we? No, we don't have the power. And I, both on the basis of studying history and on a basis of my own experiences in social movements, I understood that powerless people can create a power which the ordinary holders of power cannot suppress. I mean, I lived in the South for 7 years and participated in the movement and the movement against racial segregation, and black people were powerless. At least that's the way it seemed. I mean, it was a white-controlled society. Every office was held by whites. All policemen were white. And how are blacks going to do something about this? But they began to make little forays into the system of segregation. They began to push against it. And then there was the Montgomery bus boycott. And then there were sit-ins. And then there were freedom riots. And suddenly it appeared that when the black people of the South got together, even without money and without the police on their side, when they got together in large numbers and when they persisted and took risks and they engaged in the kind of actions of civil disobedience that drew the attention of the country and of the world, then suddenly they had power. And then the South changed in a way that nobody expected it to change. And those of us here who have been participating in social movements know that we have seen that. You can easily forget it. You can forget that in the Vietnam War, that the people who were against the war felt powerless. They're just going to go on, and they're going to carry on this war. What could we do? But the anti-war movement grew and grew and grew until it reached a large part of the population, until it reached the soldiers in the field, until it became difficult for the government to carry on the war. And then suddenly the ratio of power changed. I'll just say one more thing about that, and that is that you very often see that the people who insist, the people in power who insist, we will never change. We will never cut and run. We will hold the course. We are not going to give in. Nixon said that. He's never going to give in. He gave in. Well, George Wallace, the segregationist in the South, spoke to a huge audience in Birmingham, Alabama, and he said, thundered to them, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. A few years after that, when blacks began to vote because they had demonstrated and demonstrated and demonstrated and finally got voting legislation through Congress, several years later, Wallace changed his tune and began going around in the black neighborhoods hoping that they would vote for him. You probably know that there are these very confident statements by people in power that they will never change. But they do. When a power is created by people's sacrifice and people's unity, and yes, by a kind of spirit that animates people and keeps them going in the face of great odds.
Thank you, Howard. I'm going to jump around a little bit in that inner and outer, and again, because you have a unique perspective as such a participant in history and student in history. So, let's shift in. Let me ask you, with an American dream based so squarely on the pursuit of happiness, what are your thoughts about why so many of us are sad and frustrated?
So many of us are sad and frustrated. And I find that the people who are most sad and most frustrated are people who are not involved in some social movement. And if you're not involved in some way, it is very easy to extrapolate from your own inaction to everybody else and assume everybody else is in the same position. But, I know what you're saying about people's being disheartened. Mm. And, half of my friends are suicidal. They wake up in the morning and they think, as I do when I wake up in the morning, think, we're in an occupied country. We're being occupied by a small group of men who are taking the resources of this country, and they're not doing it to help people. They're using it in very ugly ways. But I think history helps. That is, I think people who are disheartened could use a reminder about how often in history people have been disheartened, and then once they began to move, the movement grew and grew and grew, and things changed.
So this leads to a question about, in a recent article you wrote about America's blinders.
Hmm.
So could you, I mean, you're moving toward that, and you write about this so often, but today, where we are today in this occupied country, could you talk about, in your opinion, what some of those blinders are and what they're keeping us from seeing?
Hmm. Well, one of the things they're keeping us from seeing is, as I just suggested, is our own history. Because, you know, it's a common theme among presidents and politicians that, we have a proud and wonderful history. We've always done good in the world. The world has always looked to us as a beacon. I mean, this starts way back. It starts with the Puritans of New England, and we are the city on the hill. And so there's this kind of pride verging on arrogance about what a great nation we are. And, of course, there are great things about our nation. There are great things about our country. But they're not the same great things that these people in power are talking about. The great things are what ordinary people do to survive and stay alive and resist what is being done to them. And I think the blinders, as I say, are blinders about history, and the kind of blinders that lead Americans growing up to think, oh, we're the greatest, we're number one. We're the Yankees. We always win the World Series, you know. That's where history comes in, to bring us down to earth, to make us more honest about ourselves. It's not terrible to be honest about yourself. I mean, you know, they have Alcoholics Anonymous, right, where they get up in front of the microphone and they tell the truth about their addiction. I've been thinking that we should have a group called Imperialists Anonymous. And they would get up and they would confess to their addiction. Their addiction to war and militarism. Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. And so in light of that, because there's a lot of stuff today, of course, and a lot of banter back and forth about patriotism, and I suppose in every generation that recycles. But from your long view of history and the kind of things you've been alluding to, with the blinders off, how would you define what it means to be truly patriotic?
No, that's an important question, because I'm sure a lot of people in this room have the experience that whenever you spoke up in criticism of any American policies, you were accused of being unpatriotic. And that's because we all grow up from the time, you know, we're in kindergarten, you know, Pledge of Allegiance, you know, liberty and justice for all, the Star-Spangled Banner, God save America, God bless America, I'm sorry. I guess I'm thinking, I'm intruding my own idea into it. I want him to save us instead of just blessing us for what we've done. I always wondered about, people fervently singing, you know, God bless America. Why is he picking or she picking us out to bless? There are people all over the world who deserve to be blessed, and it seems strange to me that he or she, God, would take time out to just take this small portion of mankind and bless us. But that's what we have to go up against and encounter. those are the blinders, and as I say, I think an honest look at our history, an honest look at our policies, would remove those blinders.
Who would you offer, or what comes to mind of people, either individuals, known or ordinary, or groups of people that you would consider inspiring citizens? Past or present. You know.
Oh, the kind of people who admire and embrace. Before I do that, I just realized I did not answer your question. And you were very kind enough not to say you didn't answer my question. You say, like, what is my idea of patriotism? And my idea of patriotism goes back to the Declaration of Independence, that governments are artificial creations set up in order to ensure an equal right of everybody to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And according to the Declaration of Independence, when governments become destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. Now, that's the Declaration of Independence. They don't pay a lot of attention to those words. They hang the Declaration of Independence on the schoolroom wall and, you know, refer to it on July 4th, but they don't emphasize those words, because what those words suggest is that the government is beholden to us. The government has a responsibility to do things for the people. That suggests that, well, if we have a right to overthrow or alter the government because it doesn't fulfill its responsibility, then we certainly have a right to criticize, to challenge the government. And when you do that, in consonance with the requirement of the Declaration of Independence, when you challenge the government to do the right thing, you are being patriotic. And when the government violates the principles of the Declaration of Independence and doesn't cherish life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness for its own population, then the government is being unpatriotic. Yeah.
You know, as you speak about that, it reminds me, we were just talking before about a common friend of ours, Vincent Harding, who was a contemporary of Martin Luther King and a real active leader and participant in the civil rights movement. But he often speaks about reminding us that the fact that democracy is still an experiment, that it's a live experiment that's ongoing, which your comments made me think of. So from your experience as a historian and as a participant in movements, if you had to identify one or two things that we need to accept about ourselves as a nation so we don't repeat them, what might those look
by
like?
By the way, here's another instance in which I ignored your last question. And
well, it's working, so we can just
it's
keep
working,
doing
okay.
It.
Yeah. I will always be one question behind. You say, let's get used to that. But I thought it was an important question, and that is, who are the people in the United States or in American history that you look up to? And it's an important question because young people who go to school are presented with heroes for them to emulate. And who are those heroes generally? Those heroes are presidents and industrialists and generals, military heroes. The heroes are Andrew Jackson, who was a racist and Indian hater. The heroes are Theodore Roosevelt, who loved war and approved massacres that took place in the Philippines. Well, Woodrow Wilson, whom they claim is an idealist, always, that's the word, always attached to Wilson, and they forget or want to forget that Wilson sent naval vessels to bombard the Mexican coast. He sent an army of occupation into Haiti, another army of occupation into the Dominican Republic, and he brought this country into that a slaughterhouse of World War I. These are the heroes. And my hero, and sometimes people say to me, well, we must have heroes. And I remember a guy who in the quincentennial of year of Columbus, 1492, 1992, there's a forum in New Jersey about Columbus, and I was on it. And then the chairman of the New Jersey Committee for the Celebration of Columbus was on it, and of course we differed. But at the end of it, he came over after, you know, we were talking privately. He said to me, "But you don't understand. For we Italian Americans, we need our heroes." Mm. I said, "I know that. How about Joe DiMaggio? How about Sacco and Vanzetti? There are wonderful heroes. Instead of Theodore Roosevelt, how about Mark Twain, who denounced Roosevelt for supporting massacres in the Philippines? Instead of Woodrow Wilson, how about Helen Keller, who spoke up against war? I mean, our history is full of marvelous people who stood up for peace and justice."
Yeah, thank you. This is working just fine, so if you're one behind, it's great. So to just reframe the last one, from your point of view as a historian, if there's one or two things that we need to accept about ourselves as a nation so as not to repeat them, what comes to mind to you?
I think what we have to accept is that we are people like other people in the world. That if this was a really good world, we would not have national boundaries. We would not have passports and visas and immigration quotas. The people of the world would be our brothers and sisters. The children of the world would be our children. If we understood this, then we could not go to war. Because then if we went to war, the children we kill would be our children. So I think that's, it's a big, obviously, a big step in changing our thinking, but I think it's an absolutely essential step. Because if you begin to think of yourself as special and of people elsewhere, people on the other side of the river, on the other side of the ocean, on the other side of the national boundary, as being somehow not as worthy as you are, that the children of Hiroshima do not deserve to live the way the children of ours? No. That whole idea has to be discarded. And I think we all, it's so important for us to start thinking of the human race as one. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to ask just a couple more questions, and then we'll open it up for you folks to ask questions if you'd like. So you mentioned, I know in other conversations we've had too, but in the Paris Commune and how they offered education and free for women and free theater. So that brings to mind, what role do you think that government and education should play in the social progress of a people?
The government has great resources. And if we had a government that cared about it, if we had a government that was responsive to us, that government would use its resources to encourage the arts, to encourage theater and music and poetry. And we had a glimpse of that in the 1930s. That's a kind of lost episode in American history, although some of you may know about it. And that is, as part of the New Deal program, there was something called the Federal Arts Project. And it was amazing. And the government was taking all these unemployed artists, whether they were people in theater or in music, and the government was paying them wages, not a lot, but enough to keep them going. And as a result, hundreds and hundreds of plays were put on all over the country. Hundreds and hundreds of murals were painted all over the country. Some of them are still visible in the post office walls around the country. It was a real flowering of culture. So our government doesn't do that. And by the way, governments in Western Europe spend far, far more per capita in subsidizing the arts than we do. I mean, we do a pittance. And that's something that I think people should keep in mind. We should ask for bold things. We should ask for what we think is right, even though it seems very far from what the government is prepared to do. And the arts, yes.
Well, and as a poet, thank you.
I was thinking of poets. No, really, I mean, if you're a child that says, I want to be a poet, you know what the answer is. Of what? we live in the market system. What pays gets done. If there's no profit in it, it doesn't get done. But that's where society as a whole has a role to play. Even if something is not profitable, it should be done, and the government should use its resources for that.
Well, thank you. There's two questions, and then we'll open things up here. So at the heart of the American dream question, in your opinion, is the American dream something we need to reanimate or to awaken from?
Awaken from? Well, that suggests that there are two kinds of American dreams. There's an American dream which we need to awaken from, which is a kind of distorted picture of what this country should be. And then there's a dream that we should aspire to, which is a very, very different approach and more difficult to work for, but which absolutely is essential.
And the final question is more of a personal one. Is there a moment or an experience when you realized your call to be an historian?
I like the way you put it, my call to be a historian, which gives a kind of spiritual lift to what I thought was a very mundane decision, you see. I think my time in the South, my involvement in the Southern movement, and my realization that there's a very rich history of what ordinary people were doing in the South, ordinary black people were doing in the South, which was being lost. Now, sure, they were paying attention to the sit-ins and the freedom rides and Martin Luther King, but there's much, much more to that. And I think that started me thinking when I began to write a people's history, that it was those hidden moments, those hidden actions of ordinary people that should be brought to the fore.
Thank you very much. And thank you for this wonderful sharing this in front of and with everybody. So we'd like to open for questions, which we'll do for about 20 minutes. And please come to the microphone and...
Professor Zinn, thank you. Would you care to comment on Alexis de Tocqueville on his Democracy in America 150 years ago? Of course, you are well aware of this man, and I presume many other people are, his Democracy in America and his concerns about the perils of democracy for the U.S. in this great experiment we're in.
Yeah, well, de Tocqueville had this, you know, unusual opportunity to travel in this country in the 1830s and then to write this book, Democracy in America. And he was very perceptive about certain things. One of the things he was perceptive about was the materialism of Americans, the emphasis on money and profit and ambition and getting ahead. And he was struck by that. He also had things to say about slavery, and there were things he admired about the United States and other things that he was sharply critical of, but he deserves to be reread.
Thank you very much, Professor Zinn. I'm very pleased to hear you tonight for the first time, although I'm very familiar with your work. I applaud your enthusiasm about the consciousness of American people, but the more I'm a foreigner, the more I live in this country, the more I realize that there is a tremendous amount of antagonism in this country towards people who live outside of the U.S. In particular, I'm thinking about the war in Iraq, which was supported by a large majority of Americans. And nowadays, the possibility of another war against Iran, which is more or less supported by the polls that we are seeing here and there. So to what extent all this enthusiasm about aggression and invasions abroad stand up to your very optimistic model about the American spirit, the American dream, and American people? I don't know if I can clarify what I have in mind, but I see a real contradictions here between your optimism and your goodwill, which I really appreciate and I have very much enjoyed having lived in this country for a long time, but also the other side of the story, which is the support for all this aggression abroad. And if you could please elaborate on this, I'd appreciate it.
Well, did you all hear that? Yeah. Well, you find a contradiction between my optimism, some people would say foolish optimism, romantic optimism, and the reality of so many Americans who have supported the war, right? And so many Americans who have built up a kind of antagonism towards Muslims, and of course we see that antagonism now in relation to Mexicans and so on. So the reason I maintain my hopefulness is that I'm aware of how the public can change, and I've seen the public change. And public opinion is not fixed. In fact, we have seen it in relation to the Iraq War. When the Iraq War started 3 years ago, 80% of the American public supported the war. Today, two-thirds of the American public is opposed to the war. So I think you have to look at it dynamically and see the possibilities. Once you see the possibility of change, once you can extrapolate from that and see the possibility of more change, and the people who rush to support the war are doing it on the basis of disinformation, deception. They've depended on the president and on the press to give them information, and on that basis they rush to support the war, also with a spirit of patriotism. Huh? It is a problem. But it can be overcome. And what I'm saying is it already has begun to be overcome because public opinion has changed on the war. It has changed so much on the war that the Bush administration, if you read the newspapers of the last couple of days, Bush administration has decided it must stop using this language of stay the course and we won't cut and run. The public has changed. And we've seen the public change before. I saw people, white people in the South, change in relation to racial equality. So I'm hopeful because...
But that's a high price is being paid for ignorance.
I agree, a high price. You're absolutely right. You know, while this process is going on, people are losing their lives. But there's no shortcut to that. If you think there's a shortcut, then you become hopeless. And if you become hopeless, you won't do anything. And so you have to act on the basis of a kind of faith that if you and other people continue to resist and to expose, that at some point, even though the daily cost is horrible, at some point something will change.
Hi, Professor. I'm interested in knowing what your opinion on how media has been used to shape history and to catalyze history, and how you think it's being used today, both for good and ill. I'm thinking specifically of the images of protesters being hosed and dogs sicking on them, how that woke up middle America in a lot of ways, and bodies coming home from Vietnam woke up America in a lot of ways, and how it's so strictly controlled at this day and age, and what do you think that's going to do for specifically for the war and for history as a whole?
Yeah, as you were saying, and as I also said in support of what you're saying, the media is controlled by big business, by big money. Major television stations owned by wealthy corporations. And yet, the truth comes out despite that. If that truth didn't come out in some way, see, the thing about the United States is we do have information dominated by people with money and power, but there are just enough apertures, just enough openings, just enough flexibility for determined people to get the truth out. And that's what has begun to happen. In the Vietnam War, we had the same situation where the public was not really aware of what was happening in Vietnam. And so when the Vietnam War started, two-thirds of the American people supported the war. 3 years later, two-thirds of the American people opposed the war. And what happened in the meantime? The truth began filtering through. Even into the major media, even though they came in a year or 2 years late, the story of the My Lai massacre and the pictures appearing on television of what the Marines were doing to poor peasant families in Vietnam. So we use whatever we can to get the truth out. The Internet is one way of doing it. And then we all have a responsibility. We all have a responsibility to spread the word. Write letters to your local newspaper. Call in on talk shows. Use every opportunity you have to create a different atmosphere.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Zinn, I just wrote down what you
said. Could you just speak a little closer to the microphone?
Thank you. In one breath, you praise the government for this federal program for the artists in the 30s, and at the same time, you criticize the government. So government are the people. So when people go to war and they feel that the war doesn't go well, they kind of change, and the government changes. So, and I also read on the cover of this book that these Paris Commune people were sending these balloons, that people are the same. But people are not the same, Mr. Zinn.
People what?
They are not the same. They are not similar. They say our interests are the same. They send balloon. When I came to this country, this correlates with the slogan that competition, that makes this country great. If interests are the same, it gives birth to competition. People compete with each other. And in a process of competition, people are different. Some people get to the government, like even inherited, like one President Bush, another President Bush. It's inherited, kind of like a monarchy. People like English Queen is not the same as many as her subjects. She is more educated. She has a different kind of thinking about the world. And people, her subjects, want her to be a queen. It's reveration. They say, you be a queen. People agree with that. Same with the government. And I think that I also ran experiment, like grassroots experiment, trying to change things here in Boston area on the grassroots. And I failed miserably because the system is very strong. The system allows only people with have charisma, with have, let's say, beauty, which says, have a good education, they go ahead.
Yeah.
So how would you respond to this observation?
Well, do I have an hour? No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, you have a very astute analysis of of what is going on, and I don't have, you know, I have to leave soon. And there are people behind you, you know, who want to say something. So, you know, I appreciate all the things you said. And I hope you will find the answers in my writing and Mark Nepo's writing. I'd like to direct people to my writing and also to other people's good writing, because those are very big questions you raised, and I appreciate them.
Thank you, Mr. Zen, for coming tonight. Actually, my question is sort of a follow-up to what the gentleman just said. Many historians sort of point to the government as a sort of monolithic entity that's sort of completely separate from the people or the ordinary people, as you mentioned. Hmm. So my question is it possible for an ordinary person to work for the government in some capacity in the name of public service and still do great work on behalf of the people?
It's very hard. Very hard to do that. Over the years that I've been teaching, I've had many students come to me and say, I agree with your viewpoint, your criticism of American policy, your idea of what a good society would be like, and I wonder if going into government service would give me an opportunity to advance my views. And I tell them, I doubt it. Most people are swallowed up in government service. There are occasional dissidents, whistleblowers, very occasional. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg, who worked for the government, who worked for the Rand Corporation, who then took these top secret documents, 7,000 pages marked top secret, and gave them to the press. That's rare. So I would say the chances, if I were talking to somebody who was thinking of going into government with the hope of being a force for change, I would think there are other avenues which have much more promise than working for the government.
Howard, I just want to, for one moment, you and I have talked about this. When Carl Jung first came to this country, he wrote in a letter one of his colleagues back in Europe, very interesting that he observed this paradox. He said he thought America was curious because it was a society built on the individual, and yet it was a society that maintained itself by devouring the individual.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I too am optimistic, but I have a question about the system of government, and especially the system of representation, which we call government. We continually participate in the electoral system, and what we get is something very different from what one might call representation. Our people who we elect to our legislative bodies are in no way answerable to us. They're answerable, rather, to our interests. And the separation between ourselves and our interest as conceived by the people we elect seems always to favor the American ideology of there's more where that came from. But we're no longer on the frontier. And we're no longer in a position to say there's more where that came from. And so what we get is increasing disparities of income. And these increasing disparity of income seems to be the driving machine which results in, I think, less than 5% of the world's population exploiting 25% of its resources. And we who elect this government have gotten used to the idea that there's more where that came from. So what happens to the rest of the world under these circumstances? And how is it possible to have peace? And why is it that the American people have lost the ability to read?
Lost the ability to?
Read.
To read.
Yes. Oh. You know, people can read your book. I can read American Freedom, American Slavery. I can understand the extent to which our system of government, our freedoms are based upon.
To let Howard, because we have other people.
Do you understand my question? How do we get past that? Will the world last long enough? It's resources.
It's a race. It's a race between. We do everything we can to educate people, to make people aware, to engage in actions which are themselves educational, because people are educated in social movements not just by words, but by actions, which dramatize what is happening. So we do all we can, and we understand that it's a race between our efforts and the direction in which the world is going, which is a dangerous direction. There's no simple answer, I'm afraid.
Hi, I just had a question about U.S. foreign policy.
About?
How it is influenced by Israeli Zionists. And if this influence has been helpful or hurtful towards peace in the Middle East.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part of your question.
If this influence over U.S. foreign policy has been helpful or hurtful to peace.
Are you talking about the influence of the Israeli lobby? Oh, well, no, it hasn't been helpful. Because, you know, the Israeli lobby has approached Israel in the same way that our, you know, gung-ho, super patriotic leaders approach the United States. Israel can do no wrong. And very often they rest on a half-truth, just as our leaders rest on a half-truth. A half-truth is that we're something of a democracy. There we have democratic institutions, we vote, but we're not really a democracy. And Israel has, the Knesset sees arguments, and there's an opposition newspaper, but basically the policy is determined from the top. So, it's not a healthy thing, and it therefore rests upon us to be very bold in speaking what we think is the truth.
Hello, Dr. Zinn. I had a question. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, he recently said that we're at a similar point today in Iraq as we were at the start of the Tet Offensive. And they asked Bush about it, and he said, well, yeah, that's probably right. And then today, it came out that 112, I believe, active duty military actually signed a petition to Congress asking them to leave Iraq. I was just wondering if you could comment on, do you see the similarity between now and then?
Well, there are obviously differences in detail between the war in Vietnam and the war in the Middle East, but I think the similarities are more powerful. And the fundamental similarity is that both in the case of the Vietnam War and the case of this war, the American people were lied to in order to get them to support the war. In both cases, an army was sent halfway around the world to commit enormous crimes. Remember, 2 to 3 million people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos died in the course of this war. An army sent halfway around the world to commit war crimes, and here we have an army also sent in the other direction halfway around the world to make us ashamed of what they're doing. And in both cases, the motives of the governments are being concealed under the rhetoric of, we're bringing self-determination to the Vietnamese. We're for democracy against communism, and so on. And the rhetoric is very similar today. You know, we're doing this to establish democracy in Iraq. But, of course, in both cases, there were other motives, real motives, for the war. And the motives have to do with economics. The motives have to do with corporate profit. The motives in Vietnam was access to the tin, rubber, and oil of Southeast Asia. The motive in Iraq is control of oil in the Middle East, which has been motivating American foreign policy in the Middle East ever since the end of World War II.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. Some time ago, you spoke, I think, here with Gino Strada.
More people lining up, because I'd like to cut it off very soon.
Okay, I'll be quick. You talked then about...
We will take two more questions. I'm sorry for the rest of you. We're getting very technical. Okay, your determination is powerful. Okay, go ahead.
So you were talking about world peace and how the idea of war as human instinct was dominant and is. And so I'm wondering about, I guess you were talking about the Office of Public Information that started in the, World War I, the propaganda machine, and how if war was in fact a human instinct or natural thing, then we wouldn't need to launch, or the American government would not need to launch such a vigorous campaign of propaganda saying we need to fight this war. So I was trying to explain that point this summer to a close friend, and that war is not a natural social institution. And my friend questioned it, which made me question it. And I love your work, and you. And this was difficult for me. And so
it was difficult for you?
Yes, of course. And because I'm an optimist, believe it or not. And I want to know what happened before that, because war happened then. Ward Churchill said, since 1776, there has been a war in every year, or in some kind of covert way or more overt. So I want to know what happened before World War I.
Before World War I. Before World War I, the same things happened that happened during and after World War I, and that is the United States government went on a rampage across the continent for land, basically. Land was to that time what oil is to that land. Went on and expelled and massacred the Indian populations of this continent in order to move across to the Pacific. And, you know, if you study the Mexican War, if you study the Spanish-American War, study the war in the Philippines, study our military forays into Central America in the early part of the 20th century, I believe you see the same pattern.
But I'm thinking, this before the propaganda machine, how did war happen? You said...
There was always propaganda. I mean, always propaganda. There was propaganda in the Revolutionary War. The propaganda consisted of the Declaration of Independence. This is what we're fighting for. But in fact, this is not what the slave owners were fighting for. It's not what the merchants and bondholders were fighting for. They deceived their population with slogans at that time just as today. Okay. And I think you'll find that in
I'll look into them. Thank you so much.
I just wanted to say a few of my opinions, my personal opinions, and see if you
excuse
agree
with me.
I just wanted to state a few of my opinions. Excuse me. A little nervous. Had a lot of coffee. I think that wealthy people should give more money to poor people, frankly, and I think that more stress should be sort of focused on that in general. I've studied history myself. And I also think that there's a lot of obviousness into the truth and lies that are going on now. And I think it's more focusing on something like that, because that actually, I think, stops war, the even distribution of the wealth. And there's probably a few millionaires in this room, and if they were to drop $1,000 into one of the bum's cups outside, then they could... benefit spiritually and also do something good for the world. And they might buy booze or drugs or whatever, but they would also buy some food, you know? So I was wondering what you thought of that.
Is that a question?
I don't know.
It's a statement, right?
It's a statement, I guess. But I'm asking, my question is, do you agree?
I accept your statement.
Okay.
It's time that somebody made a statement instead of asking a question. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wealthy people should give more money to poor people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, this is the last.
Last one. Hi, Howard. All right, so let's just say for 1 minute that the society overthrows the government and, you know, uses the Declaration of Independence to for its face value. Or, maybe better, all the politicians maybe wake up one day and, you know, have an epiphany and say, oh, hey, let's change the course. You know, let's get out of the Middle East and all, you know, this tumultuous political time. What can we as a country or possibly as an individual do to extinguish the hatred that the world has of us so that when we let down our guard, we don't have to feel like we have to defend ourselves against the rest of the world?
Oh, I'm trying to understand what you said or what you asked. Yes, what?
What can we do to extinguish the hatred that
to what?
Extinguish the hatred that we've bred throughout the world.
Do you understand that question?
I think that, what can we do to, once we let our guard down, and what can we do to extinguish the hatred that we've bred around the world?
People around the world are also able to change their opinions. When the United States changes its policy in the world, people in the world will change their attitude to the United States. And, I think people are open to something good when they see something good happens. And so I think we should have the kind of faith that says, when we begin to behave differently, when we stop starting wars and invading other countries, and we start using our enormous resources to help people, well, I think people all over the world are going to respond to that and look upon us differently.
Thank you.
Paul?
Yeah. Thank you. What did you want to do something
I'll
first?
Say, thank you, Howard Zinn, and thank you, Mark Nepo.
Yeah. Mark has a poem that he would like to read.
And now Mark is going to read one of his poems.
I want to close with a poem here, and I want to thank you all for your questions, and also as well Pat and Howard for your giving forth so much, so freely to folks. This is called Earth Prayer. Let us, when swimming with the stream, become the stream. Let us, when moving with the music, become the music. Let us, when rocking the wounded, become the suffering. Let us live for the grace beneath all we want. Let us see it in everything and everyone, till we admit to the mystery that when I look deep enough into you, I find me. And when you dare to hear my fear in the recess of your heart, you recognize it as your secret, which you thought no one else knew. Oh, let us have the courage to hold each other when we break and worship what unfolds. Let us embrace that unexpected moment of unity as the atom of God. O nameless spirit that is not done with us, let us live without a net beyond the fear of death until the speck of peace we guard so well becomes the world.